Hello, two-fisted assassins and regular Saturday night things and all the ships at sea, and welcome to A Very Good Year, the movie podcast where we invite a guest to pick their favorite year of movies and talk to us about that year. I'm your host, Jason Bailey, and across the mic and halfway across the country from me is my co-host,
Michael Hull.
We are back in Austin, again visiting for South by Southwest, and our guest today is an Austin legend. He's a baller film critic, as well as a screenwriter, novelist, and co-host of the Secret Handshake podcast. His byline has appeared at Birth Movies, Death, Fangoria, and more, and he's also, for my money, one of the very best follows that you can gift yourself on Letterboxd. Here he is, your pal and mine, Jacob Knight. Hey, Jacob.
Hello, everyone.
Thank you so much for doing this, for getting up in the morning right before South by to come out and meet up. It's nice to to talk in person. It's always a pleasure when we can do that.
Especially in this very sterile Art Deco conference room.
Warm, accommodating. The press center said, we want to give you a space, and we also want it to be really homey.
Yeah.
So I will wax rhapsodic about South by at the drop of a hat. It is my favorite film festival. I like the populism of the selections, but more than anything, I just love the vibe of the event. I love having an excuse to come to Austin, and I appreciate the opportunity to come bask in the Austin sun coming out of a miserable New York winter. As an Austin resident, I would imagine you have a more complicated feeling about this period on the calendar, or no? How does it hit for a local?
I don't actually. I've been here for 11 years, and honestly, it's one of the reasons I moved here was to be closer to Fantastic Fest and South by Southwest. And honestly, back in the day when Alamo Drafthouse was a little less corporate, to be able to hit all of their screenings, Austin Film Society,
right,
the sadly departed Vulcan Video, and I Love Video. But I mean, you know, not too long ago, this was the premier city to actually, or one of the premier cities that wasn't New York and LA, to actually come and watch movies in.
Right.
And South by, you know, regardless of whether or not it congests everything, it's still quite the spectacle every year. So I look forward to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and you pinpointed too, one of the reasons I love coming here is it really, you get a sense that it is a film town.
Yes.
In a way that I haven't experienced in a lot of other places aside from sometimes New York and sometimes LA. What do you think why do you think that's such a factor here? Why do you think such a vibrant film culture managed to sort of explode and continue to exist here?
I mean, the short answer is Richard Linklater.
Okay.
I mean, in all honesty, when he co-founded Austin Film Society, he helped bring the entire idea, not idea, but like that culture of like, let's watch movies together.
Right.
You know, let's find prints of these obscure art house films. Let's watch French New Wave movies together. Let's find Bellatar movies and watch them together. And then, you know, kind of in the spirit of that, you have the Alamo Drafthouse coming on his heels and, you know, buying up whole pallets of old exploitation movies and showing them at Weird Wednesday, Terror Tuesday. Like you said to me in the lobby as we were walking up, you went to a Weird Wednesday screening last night. And it's one of your kind of rituals before South by starts. I mean, that's part of the spirit of the city now, which has dissipated, let's say, post-COVID a little bit. And I mean, I parked down near 6th Street and walked by the old Ritz Theater, which is now Joe Rogan's comedy mothership, which kills my soul a little bit. But I mean, that's honest. The short answer really is Rick Linklater, because, and then, you know, the Paramount Theater, South by coming up, that's where it comes from. And then the rest of the town was kind of built around that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a nice environment to be in. All right. Well, let's get to the matter at hand. What year did you choose to talk to us about and why?
1989, because in a strange way, I love 80s films, to be quite frank. And 1989 denotes a kind of, let's say, change, to where you're watching a bunch of trends kind of exit and then you're transitioning into the 90s. So movies are kind of in this, especially with the type of cult genre type stuff that I wallow in a lot of the time. you're seeing a lot of change as we move into the 90s. You're seeing a lot of trends kind of go out with the slasher movies. You see a lot of sequels this year, with especially with horror movies. But then also you're seeing action movies kind of transition from the big muscled Stallone, Schwarzenegger explosion fests into stuff like, you know, the Joel Silver-led, like, Die Hard. You're seeing the end of the Charles Bronson era with Canon. And then also, like, you're seeing Hong Kong movies kind of come into the video stores and everything. And you're also seeing James Cameron, which will be one of the movies we talk about here, try something different, even though it's sort of the same. And but that's one of the reasons I picked it, because, you know, outside of, and let's be frank, you had already done an episode on 1989 with Jay Pearson, correct? Which covered a lot of the great independent movies like Sex, Lies, and Videotape, Do the Right Thing. Like, all of that's happening on the side, and those are all kind of monumental films in their own right. But then this is happening sort of in the genre space at the same time, and it's just a really fascinating transitional year.
Right, right. So when you talk about it then as a transitional year, what are the sort of the trends, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, that would replace the things that are going away in 89 in the sort of years to come?
You're going to see, like, for example, I bring up Stallone, Schwarzenegger. Right. Like, one of the big movies that hits at the end of 89 is Tango and Cash, and which is, for me, one of the periods at the end of, like, the muscle-bound, oil dude kind of sentence. You'd still have Cliffhanger and things like that in the 90s, but you have the introduction of, like in 1989, you have three Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. Mm-hmm. You have Bloodsport, Cyborg, and Kickboxer, all from Canon Films. Right. And that's kind of bringing in this next wave of guy who's, like, even though he shares a lot of qualities with, like, the Stallones and Schwarzeneggers of the world, he kind of has his own juice, we'll say, that he brings. And then you'll also see guys that come up alongside him, like Steven Seagal, which would be more in, like, 1990 with stuff like Above the Law and Hard to Kill, that you're just seeing a new wave of guys coming in as almost like competition to mm-hmm. Stallone and Schwarzenegger, who also, again, have their own, they become brands until themselves. You know, and then the big one that I want to talk about would also be the end of the slasher movie. Like, you're literally seeing it in 1989, the end of three major, not the end, because
but at least a pause. Yeah.
But you'll see a definitive kind of breaking points in three separate slasher movie franchises that are kind of like the Mount Rushmore of slashers.
All right, well, we're going to get into all of that, and we're actually going to start with that. So we're just going to put a pin in that for half a second. Mike is going to fill us in on what was happening in the world outside the multiplex in 1989. Here's headlines.
1989 was all about things that weren't happening in America. But Americans had thoughts.
Yes.
And influence on uh-huh. some of those things. Cold Warrior George H.W. Bush was inaugurated as president of the United States and somehow isn't the worst person in his family at that job.
Mm-hmm.
He tried, though.
Gave it the old college try, the old Yale sure blue did. Blood piece of shit CIA fuck try.
The big headline is usually referred to as the fall of the Berlin Wall, but most of it didn't actually fall down.
Yes.
Just some small pieces.
Yeah.
They just stopped policing the gates and let people from East Germany into West Berlin, mostly to go to better discos and visit family.
Sure. Good.
You know, buy some chocolate.
Absolutely.
Who is the they that stopped policing the gates, you ask? Well, that would be the commies, as represented by the Central Comintern of the Soviet Union. All of this is just fancy language to say the old Russian Empire was finally coming to an end, like all the other old European empires of the 20th century.
Yep.
Good riddance to bad trash.
There we go.
1989. It was, you know, it really, like, it all sort of like came crumbling down in 91, but by 89, it was sort of obvious that there were too many leaks to plug.
Yep.
Salman Rushdie's novel Satanic Verses made a lot of people mad who didn't actually read it. I don't think they read it.
They did not. They did not. It's a dense text, and these do not strike me as particularly literarily intellectual people.
I think they read like a press release and was like, fuck that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Perennial douchebag Oliver North was convicted in the Iran-Contra affair, and I'm not going to get into the details, but I will just say that by any measure, that man is not a patriot.
That is fair. That is fair. Got a lot of t-shirts out of that, though. I remember all the t-shirts, him being sworn in to tell a bunch of
There were pro-democracy protests in China who were looking at the Russians and saying, like, not on my fucking watch.
Mm-hmm.
We always see the video of, like, the one guy with his grocery bag, like, his little handle grocery bag right in front of the tanks at Tiananmen Square, right? That's, like, that's the picture we always see and the picture we saw a lot then. But it's estimated that millions of people joined those protests. They're the largest pro-democracy protests. They haven't had bigger ones since.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know they made a 30-foot-tall styrofoam statue as part of the protest? Do you know what they made a statue of?
I do not, Mike. What did they make a statue of? Is this a riddle? Are you telling me like a bubblegum joke?
No, it's a real thing. It's sort of heartwarming, depending on how you feel about the universe. They made a 30-foot-tall styrofoam Statue of Liberty.
I like that. That's delightful.
I know. Is that, as an American, are we supposed to like that?
I think we can like that. I think it's okay.
But it's a nice story.
It is.
It's a good thing to see.
It is.
There's a lot of music that came out, but the popular stuff was almost universally terrible.
Accurate.
You know, like, I like Sonic Youth, too, but nobody, that's not what people were listening to. New Kids on the Block, anyone?
No.
Ricky Martin and Menudo?
No, thank you.
Yeah.
On the other side
of the spectrum, I think GNR Lies came out in 89. That's the one where he says a bunch of racist stuff and talks about burying his girlfriend in the yard.
That's true.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Thank God for Public Enemy and Rakim. De La Soul, am I right?
You're right.
Finally, the biggest news of 1989 that no one cared about at the time was the invention of a thing we now know of as the internet by a guy named Tim Berners-Lee. I would congratulate him or thank him maybe, but I assume he can't hear me because he spends his life swimming around in an Olympic-sized pool full of cash. That's headlines.
Thank you, Mike. Jacob Knight, you ready to do a top five?
Certainly am. Top five, more dead than
alive. All right, so we decided to do this is a roughly ranked list.
Yeah, it's fair.
It's fair. It's rankish.
I mean, the shittiest movie is definitely.
I mean, I'm not going to argue with you about that. So what then, Jacob Knight, is the number five movie on your top five for 89?
Well, it only felt appropriate talking to a couple of New York dudes that I would do.
One of the great New York movies
of all time.
Taxi Driver, Pelham 123, and
Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan.
Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. New York has a new problem. Rated R. Starts Friday, July 28th at theaters everywhere.
Which, to be fair, bad movie, great teaser trailer.
Oh, incredible teaser trailer.
The whole, like, dude, dude.
Oh, yeah. No, we will play the clip from
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah. This hulking beast looking out over the bay and then turns around and it reveals to be Jason Voorhees. Now, obviously, a notorious film because most of it doesn't take place in New York at all. It takes place on a boat.
On a fucking boat.
That goes from Crystal Lake to Manhattan, which I don't know how that even works.
That's a really renowned trade route, I believe, if I remember my American history correct.
But it was used by the Dutch.
Yes.
But here's the thing about this movie, though, is that this is probably the movie I've watched the most on this list, simply because there is a nostalgia value to it, because back in the day, I was, you know, 8 or 9 when this movie hit cable originally.
Okay.
And I used to collect, even as a little kid, the old TV guides because I was fascinated by the capsules. I would go through the capsules and this kind of, I guess, was a prediction of where my taste would go, is that I would circle the most lurid sounding shit
absolutely.
That I could found. And then I was like, Friday the 13th, Part 8, Jason Takes Manhattan. Wait, I know who this Jason guy is.
Right.
He actually goes to New York at some point?
Yes.
That's crazy.
And takes Manhattan? Did he take it from the Muppets? Like,
Fuck yeah. I'm in on all of that. Wait. Well, I stayed up, because my parents, of course, would not let me watch this movie at like 9 years old. I stayed up until 3 or 4 in the morning, I want to say, snuck downstairs and watched it on our old TV. Now, here's the thing. I overslept, So I only saw the last 30 minutes of this movie the first time. So I only saw the Manhattan sequence more or less. So to me, as a little kid, I was like, this is the greatest fucking movie I've ever seen. Yeah. There's toxic waste in New York. This was also one of my first exposures to New York. So as a child, I was like, oh, of course. Naturally, they flush the sewers of toxic waste every night at midnight. That makes total sense.
Of course.
But here's the thing. The other thing about this movie is that in 1989, you have the end of three major slasher franchises, or at least before they kind of change hands, we'll say, because this is the last Paramount Jason, which I would learn much later when I actually started to really get into movies and even go to film school, is that New Line would then take the series over. They would do Jason Goes to Hell, which I don't know. You could argue is, I guess, a better movie than this, but it's its own thing entirely. Yeah. And then they would do Jason X, which is certainly a better movie than both of those.
Of course.
Because Jason goes to space.
Yes.
And you have – this is the last movie that kind of captures that Paramount vibe, though.
Right.
Where they felt like cheapy one-offs that they were trying to churn out every year, which for my money we really wouldn't get in a true sense until the Saw movies year later. Like, that would be a different generation's basically version of the Friday the 13th films. But so you have the end of Jason Takes Manhattan. You also have Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers.
Right.
And you have A Nightmare on Elm Street 5, The Dream Child, which is kind of like the last of the serialized Jason or Freddy movies, I should say, before you get, I think, 2 years later, Freddy's Dead, The Finals Nightmare. But then also in 1989, you have a ton of just sequels. Like, it was clear that they were the horror movie kind of boom that took up the 80s, and that people have tried to figure out, like, why were slashers so big in the 80s? Was it about greed and capitalism? Was it about Reagan's America? Like, people have tried to assign all of these motivations for why these movies were so popular.
Totally.
The thing is, they were just cheap, like, gnarly little roller coasters that you could go on and feel safe. And then because you also see at the end of this decade and in 1989, you have The Fly 2, which is actually pretty good.
I've heard,
Fright Night Part 2, which is bad. Mm-hmm. Ghostbusters 2. Also bad.
Yes, correct.
Stepfather 2, directed by the late, great Jeff Burr, who sadly just passed this year. And then Chud 2, Bud the Chud, which stars Garrett Graham, who was De Palma's roommate at one point, and kind of has nothing to do with the original Chud, which, while we're at on the topic of New York horror movies,
is one of the great scummy
kind of splatterpunk New York horror movies. But you also have, Wes Craven more or less trying to invent a new icon to replace Freddy with Shocker, with Horace Pinker, which is a kind of undervalued horror movie that came out of this year. And you also have Robert Englund directing 976 Evil, Stephen Jeffries, future porn, gay porn star Stephen Jeffries, which 976 Evil fucking rules. If you've never seen that movie, like, that will blow the back of your head out of your skull. So, I mean, Jason Takes Manhattan, I've always come back to it. I find kind of like a junky comfort food sort of feeling in revisiting this film every time, even though, like, I'm never going to sit here and be like, yo, it's good. Actually, no, it's a piece of shit, but I like it.
That is the best possible button for that conversation.
I just have to say, shout out to somebody who starts their top five by saying, look, this movie sucks, and then has the balls to carry on. Yeah. I just shout out to Austin.
Bravo. Bravo for that.
I saw that on 35mm in Austin a couple years ago.
Of course they showed it, and of course you went. Jacob Knight, what then is the number four movie on your top five for 1989?
Well, that's actually a great kind of transitional topic is movie screenings in Austin. I'm glad that you brought it up at the beginning of the episode, is that Miracle Mile, when I first moved here, was one of the movies that I discovered by just going to rep screenings in Austin.
Love can be exciting.
Trust me with this.
Even terrifying.
Julie! Julia! I love you!
But nothing could prepare you for an experience like this.
What is it, Julia?
Miracle Mile.
Listen, I'm just a guy who picked up the phone.
When I first moved here over a decade ago, it was the town where you could literally go to bring up the Ritz again. Mm-hmm. I didn't have any money. I worked at a video store making like less than 10 bucks an hour, you know, was eating, you know, breakfast tacos for, you know, morning, noon and night, we'll say. But then going to the Ritz where you could go to like a random Thursday night and for $5 could see something like Miracle Mile or The Legend of Billie Jean or Over the Top or like just the list is endless with the amount of discoveries that I kind of had when I first moved here. And Miracle Mile was one of them. And for me, this is one of the sleeper contenders for one of my favorite subgenres in film, which is, man, this dude's just really having a fucking bad night.
Yes.
Because
After Hours, of course.
Except, well, I was going to say, this movie's kind of like if you were to take a Brundlefly machine and put After Hours in it with like a little bit of Repo Man and just like shit it out. Like that's the whole vibe of this film. Definitely. And I love Anthony Edwards. I love Mira Winningham in it. You know, it, in a weird twist of fate, it premiered on 9/11 in 1988 at the Toronto Film Festival, which now feels strange in hindsight. Wasn't a hit when it first came out, only made about $1 million, actually came out on the same weekend as Roadhouse, strangely enough. But for all of the bleakness and for all of the apocalyptic kind of dread that pervades this film, because for those, I guess, who have never seen this somewhat obscure cult movie still, I would say, it's about a guy who falls in love with a girl. They're about to go out on their third date and consummate the relationship. It's Anthony Edwards, you know, pre-ER, you know, doctor fame. And he's just tremendous in this. Like, I love him. He has, like, one of the greatest energies of any kind of leading man. He meets this kind of punky, spunky girl at a museum where he's more or less, like, kind of taking over like a kid's field trip and like giving them like alternative histories of humankind. And they decide tonight's like the night. They're finally gonna get it on. And he oversleeps through a series of twisted fates, we'll say, and answers the wrong phone call where he finds out that the missiles have been launched and there's an hour left in humanity's existence, and all he wants to do is get across town and see this girl one last time and be with her. And beyond the discovery portion of it, this became a big movie for me during COVID, where I revisited it a bunch of times because it captures the idea, not to get too sappy or sentimental, that we all just want somebody to die with in the end. And that's the thing that I keep clinging to, is that for all the apocalyptic dread, all of the doom and gloom and frankly the manic kind of paranoia that pervades this movie, like, it's in the end a very romantic film, and it's about two people who just want to be together because they need somebody to hold on to while the world ends. And that's a hard sentiment to argue with. Miracle Mile, that's my number four.
Man, I'm so glad that you brought up COVID during that, because here's my, I don't know if you remember, but right when lockdown happened, a lot of the like boutique labels did like big sales, you know, because they were like, everybody's going to be stuck home for a while. Let's sell some fucking product. One of those was Arrow Video. I did a big Arrow Video order and I got Miracle Mile, which I had never seen. So I watched this movie for the first time.
Oh, Jesus.
During COVID lockdown. So I feel what you are talking about in a very, very real way. It has that vibe. It has that end of the world feeling in a way that I think very few other movies have captured.
Well, I mean, and it's strange because I remember walking the streets of Austin with my girlfriend during COVID and it being completely locked down because we both work in restaurants.
Right.
And we would go downtown because we both had keys to the respective restaurants that we worked at. And we would let ourselves in with a couple other friends and we would sit there and it literally was like being at the the pub at the end of the world. Yes. While watching nobody but like unhoused folks basically shriek throughout the streets. It was a moment from like Dawn of the Dead or something. Yeah. And this movie just kind of captured like what you wanted. Were those moments, were those like at least we might be sitting 6 feet apart while we drink these stolen beers in this abandoned restaurant, but at least we have each other.
All right, Jacob, what then is the number three movie on your 1989 top five?
It only felt appropriate since you're here for South by Southwest, since this is the opening night movie, the remake of this film, Roadhouse.
How's a guy like you end up a boss?
Just lucky, I guess.
Dalton's an unusual guy, and he's got an unusual job. His reputation is impressive.
I run the show completely.
And his demands are simple.
Be nice until it's time to not be nice.
Patrick Swayze.
Do you always carry your medical records around with you?
Saves time.
Roadhouse, rated R. Now playing at theaters everywhere.
From director Rowdy Harrington, and a name I will never miss the opportunity to say that Roadhouse was directed by a guy named Rowdy.
I had him on Secret Handshake.
Nice.
I interviewed him for Roadhouse because I always wanted to talk to him because he's actually my family originally is from Pittsburgh. Okay. And he's a Pittsburgh guy, and he worked his way up as an old school kind of tradesman doing grip work, doing sound, being a union guy, showing up to sets, and that's how he learned the craft. Was
really
doing everything from like low budget horror movies to working on mid to high level kind of studio films, and he more or less like taught himself how to make movies. And he made a couple movies besides Roadhouse that are quite good. He made Jack's Back with James Spader, which is quite good, and then he would make another movie, which I think is kind of the perfect companion piece to this because at its heart, Roadhouse is a Western.
Yes.
It's very much him making a Howard Hawksian guy comes into to town and cleans it all up, which he made Nowhere to Run with Jean-Claude Van Damme, too, which has a very similar vibe. Yeah. Stranger comes into this kind of isolated family and kind of helps them fight off. If it were made in the 50s, they would be like cattle ranchers.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But here's the thing about Roadhouse. There's two types of people in this world. There's people who unironically love this movie, and then there's fucking assholes. Because I will never buy into Roadhouse being one of these like so bad it's good films because like when you watch it, the level of craft that goes behind its ridiculousness is kind of undeniable because you have Dean Cundey shooting this movie. You have Mark Kamen providing a score, which sounds pretty similar to Die Hard.
Sure.
But like, and then honestly, the Patrick Swayze of it all is kind of undeniable. Like they just knew what vibe they were getting into from like the pink font that opens it, from the opening shot of that Ferrari pulling into a shithole like dive bar parking lot.
The title card is over a woman's ass.
That's
Jacob.
What I'm saying. Like this is like this they knew what they were doing. And a lot like recently the Rewatchables just did an episode on this movie, I think this week. Okay. And they were talking about, do you think they were in on the joke? Do you think this? And I was like, I'm listening to it and I want to just scream into like the ether. There's no fucking joke. Yeah. Like this is just, it's what makes Roadhouse so awesome is that it's so sincere. It believes in its own bullshit. And I can't commend the movie enough. But to kind of take it to the central theme of this list and sort of how we're watching like a transition, is that action movies in the 80s can almost be summed up by the main producer of Roadhouse's entire career throughout the 80s, which is Joel Silver.
Right.
So you kind of start, I mean, he's an associate producer on The Warriors, again, one of the great New York movies in the late 70s. But his first major kind of movie is 48 Hours, like one of his first major hits in 82. Then you have Streets of Fire in 84, which is a dud, but, you know, one of the greatest movies
kind
ever
of fucking
made.
Rips, yeah.
Commando in 85, which helps kind of establish Schwarzenegger's entire brand. And then he has Lethal Weapon and Predator in 87.
He's still living off 87 money at
That's
the moment.
That's what I'm saying. He has Action Jackson and Die Hard in 88. Yeah. And then he has Roadhouse and Lethal Weapon 2, which I think Lethal Weapon 2 was like the number two or three movie of this year in 89. You can track every trend in action movies basically just through one dude. Like, this guy just kind of had his finger on the pulse of like what people wanted to see when it came to people kicking the fuck out of each other. So, and then you also have in 89 a great double feature of Patrick Swayze movies, because, you know, before this he was the Dirty Dancing guy, he was the Red Dawn guy. Like, that's the closest that you kind of get to what Roadhouse is. But you have Next of Kin with him and Liam Neeson also in 89, which is a pretty nice kind of undervalued little film. But then when you compare it to, like, say, what Cannon Films was doing in the 80s, is that you have... Have you ever seen Kinjite Forbidden Subjects?
I'm afraid so, yes.
Yeah, where, where Charles Bronson, I believe, violates a man during an interrogation process.
Sure does.
You also have American Ninja 3 and then the three Jean-Claude Van Damme movies. But they were chasing a trend in the same way that Joel Silver was. But what Joel Silver kind of pinpointed is that there were two things that people wanted to see in the 80s when it came to action movies. Mm-hmm. The big muscle dudes, which he really got in on with Commando and Predator with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and also Action Jackson with the sadly departed Carl Weathers. But then he also got in on the idea of, like, what would it be like if this dude who you never thought could front an action movie was actually our hero? And, like, he really starts that with Nick Nolte in 48 Hours.
Yeah.
But then he also gets... you know, Bruce Willis famously with Die Hard. And I think to a lesser degree, Mel Gibson in the Lethal Weapon movies. Well, definitely Danny Glover,
right?
You could argue is part of that formula. But like, Swayze totally fits in there because, like, this guy was a dancer.
Right.
Like, nobody thought that he was gonna come in like roundhouse kicking motherfuckers in the face and like just spitting some of the greatest Zen lines of all time as Dalton.
Right.
So, I mean, he, for my money, Roadhouse is like, because I believe before we started recording, Michael brought up that they're bringing it back at a bunch of, like, his local rep house. And you're going to see a bunch of screenings, especially with the Gyllenhaal one hitting theaters. I guess not hitting theaters, hitting fucking streaming.
Yeah.
But, like... If you have the chance, if this is playing in your area, go see it with people.
Yeah.
Like, you want to watch people absolutely lose their fucking minds over a movie. Like, yeah, some of them might be doing it ironically, but, like, Roadhouse just absolutely kills if you see it with the right crowd. And I love this movie to death, and I love it sincerely, and fuck everybody else.
Fair. Fair enough. I've come around on this one. I watched it the first time to sneer at it. And I rewatched it a couple of years ago, and I was like, no, this is actually fucking awesome. And a level of craftsmanship that we so took for granted in this era.
Yeah.
That is, like, kind of astonishing now.
Well, and also, we haven't even mentioned the Ben Gazzara of it all.
Oh, hell yes.
Who's, as Brad Wesley, is one of the great screen villains of all time.
Absolutely.
Entering at a pool party in a bright pink bathrobe, smoking a cigar, while some complete goon dances on a table. He's like, hey, I like this guy. And you're like, what the fuck is going on in this movie?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good, it is a good time.
Everybody else who does the, like, this is my like car I drive. This is my like car I only bust out in emergencies thing. Mm-hmm. Like they all got that from this movie. Right?
Oh yeah.
An earlier version of that.
No, absolutely not.
That most of us normies aren't aware of, or is everybody just aping Rhoda?
Yeah, I think they're just aping Dalton's Mercedes.
Beautiful. Well, speaking of new trends in action cinema, Jacob, what then is the number two movie for 89?
Well, here's the thing, is that the number two movie is kind of a cheat because it premiered in Taiwan in like March of 89 and then Hong Kong in July of 89 and didn't really hit the United States until film festivals with like the Palm Springs Film Festival, Sundance, and then it went to Cannes in 90. And that's John Woo's The Killer.
A film concocted with nitroglycerin, the combined energy of the Road Warrior, RoboCop, and the Terminator. The Killer is great cinema. The Killer, a thriller comedy that will leave you breathless.
Which, for my money, not only changed action movies, but change just movies in general. Yeah. Because if you don't have The Killer, if you don't have all of the style and Chow Yun-Fat and the two-fisted gunfights and the slow motion and the fucking doves, like, you don't have everything from Quentin Tarantino to John Wick.
Yeah.
You know, like, the influence of this film can still be felt to this day.
Yeah.
And it's hard, like, it's also one of those movies that when you go back and you revisit it, none of its power is lost.
No.
Like, it's just, you want to talk about craft. Like, nobody has ever realized the thrilling power of screen violence quite like John Woo. And, like, the end of this movie where it's just a legion of faceless thugs coming to take down Chow Yun-Fat's now morally reclaimed hitman.
Right.
It's, you know, it takes your breath away every time. And I love this movie to death. And I do think it's also interesting that in 89, even though this movie really wouldn't have its impact until it hit VHS in like the early 90s, when it became a video store staple for guys like Quentin Tarantino out in like video archives and stuff, is that you also have an 89, a movie that I love and actually ranks, I think, as one of the not only most undervalued Ridley Scott films, but one of his best movies in general, is Black Rain, which is about a couple of fish out of water detectives going to Japan to go retrieve a criminal, which I don't know how that works in terms of jurisdiction, but like, we'll let it roll.
Yeah.
But that kind of, that has a very similar vibe and almost feels predictive in a way, where The Killer was all, was the future, you know? But yeah, that would be my pick for number two, because if you haven't seen The Killer, go out and find it. It's a little hard to see now because of all the weird right stuff, but I think it's actually on Disney Plus of all places.
God, who knows? You know, the thing about this one for me is that this was the first Hong Kong action movie I ever saw.
For a lot of people.
I think mostly from Quentin's advocacy of John Woo. Like, I was working at Hollywood Video. It was in the foreign film section. I took it home one night and I rewatched it for the show because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And I still, when that first shootout happens.
Oh, when he kicks the table over and catches the gun?
Yes.
Fuck yeah, dude.
Like, I still got the goosebumps that I got the first time I saw that.
It's impossible not to.
When I'm seeing something really new in movies. Like when I'm seeing a whole style redefined in front of my eyes, like that was what that first viewing felt like. And it still feels that way when you watch it.
We were doing a very short screening series here in Austin for Secret Handshake, and we actually showed Hard Boiled, which is kind of like the ultimate John Woo movie, where we're talking about periods at the end of a sentence. Like that felt like him being like, okay, I'm done with this kind of brand of action. But that has a very similar feeling. And to kind of go back to what you were talking about with discovering these movies on, you know, when you were working at Hollywood Video, I was the same way. As I was working, I think, at Blockbuster at the time as a kid, and we had miraculously Akira, A Better Tomorrow, The Killer, and Hard Boiled. And I took them all home at different points in time. And I think my entire perspective of what cinema could be changed in those moments.
Absolutely. All right. Well, then that brings us to the big one. That brings us to the number one, the favorite for 1989, Jacob Knight. What is it?
James Cameron's The Abyss.
Moment of truth. Let's go.
Forget everything you've ever seen. Forget everything you've ever heard. Forget everything you've ever experienced. There's everything you've ever known about adventure. And then, there's The Abyss, rated PG-13. Opens Wednesday, August 9th at theaters everywhere.
I don't think it's not my very favorite James Cameron movie. That's always going to be Terminator 2 Judgment Day. It is the one that I always maybe admire the most, because it felt like him trying to do something different. You want to talk about, you're talking about deeply romantic movies like Miracle Mile. The Abyss is like, man, especially when you, if you watch the 3-hour kind of director's cut of this film, it is like about rediscovering the power of humanity and the power of love, as corny as that sounds, in the face of apocalypse, in the face of these aliens, and these aliens actually finding a way to essentially justify sparing us at the end of this movie is because of love. But it's also just like all of his movies, one of the great technical accomplishments that you'll ever witness. I mean, famously, one of the hardest shoots that ever occurred. They shot, I think, for something like 6 months in an abandoned nuclear power plant that was once owned by, I think it was the Cherokee nuclear power plant in North Carolina, that was owned by Earl Owensby, the Southern exploitation magnate, who just kind of owned it and then rented it out to 20th Century Fox. But it also, in 1989, was part of a mini subgenre that we only lasted 1 year, which was creepy underwater kind of horror movies.
Yep.
Because to take it back to Jason and Friday the 13th, you know, everybody knew that Cameron, following The Terminator, writing First Blood Part 2, and then Aliens, he, talk about a guy who had his finger on the pulse of like what people wanted to see. Right. He was a huge hit. He was a wunderkind at that point. And, you know, they all knew that he was working on this movie, The Abyss, because it, the production just kept going and going and going and going and seeming like it was never going to stop, to the point that we're like, Ed Harris won't talk about this movie in public. Because I think at one point he even punched James Cameron in the face almost dying on screen.
Didn't make sense.
And, you know, you do.
Yeah.
But Sean Cunningham, who, you know, the infamous story about how Friday the 13th came about was that, you know, they looked in the trades, saw how much money Halloween was making, and he made a phone call and was like, hey, Halloween's making a bunch of money, let's rip it off.
Yeah.
And he did the same thing with The Abyss. Is he was like, James Cameron's making this movie, it's going to make a bunch of money, let's make something, and beat him to theaters. And he did, and it was Deep Star 6,
right,
which sucks.
Right.
I like, it's another movie that sucks and I like part of it, but it's not good.
Right.
But the movie I will go ride or die for, and I just saw on 35 millimeter last year at one of the Exhumed Films festivals that they hold on the East Coast, is Leviathan. Okay. The George P. Cosmatos underwater kind of creepy crawly movie that is more or less like an Alien knockoff, just underwater as opposed to in space. Has also one of the craziest casts you'll ever see in a movie, with like Richard Crenna and Daniel Stern, and great Stan Winston special effects. If you've never seen that one, I think Shout Factory has a Blu-ray you can check out. And then there's also, as there always was, a Roger Corman answer to it with Lords of the Deep.
Yep.
And the next year there would be another one that kind of comes close with the director of one of my favorite slasher movies of all time, and one of the great audience movies of all time, Pieces. Juan Pierre Simone made a movie called The Rift that had Ray Wise in it, which kind of turns into like Aliens if Aliens were made for like the cost of a bologna sandwich. But in short, The Abyss is like James Cameron. I don't think that we have the James Cameron that we have today if The Abyss didn't exist. Mm-hmm. Because it feels like something that he had to get out of his system, especially as a guy who notoriously has some relationship issues, we'll say. Yeah. And he's kind of working a lot of that out through his own kind of sci-fi genre spectacle. And he gets that out of the way, and then he's able to make stuff like Terminator 2, True Lies, the Avatar films eventually. But like The Abyss still remains kind of an anomaly in his filmography that I love to this day. And I honestly can't wait to I didn't see any of the 4K screenings when they happened, but I can't wait to watch it at home on disc because I love this movie to death.
Yeah, yeah. It, I hadn't seen it since original VHS release, and I rewatched it for the thing. And man, it is a terrific movie. The main thing I kept thinking about during it was like, boy, Jim Cameron just loves to hang out with people on a crew. He just loves to make a movie about a crew of mostly dudes doing a thing, you know? Like, he's coming off this into Aliens. There's all that stuff in Titanic, of course, Avatar. He really just likes that relationship, that dynamic, that camaraderie in those sort of confined spaces, which I think is fascinating.
Yeah, they're all very blue-collar, muscular. Yeah.
I mean, they're all, you know, it's all him. They're all about making a movie. You know, they're all, that's like the crew dudes in all of his movies. He's just like, you know, they're actually underwater. Yeah, but they're making a movie. It is a lot of fun. And some of the best acting I think Ed Harris ever did. Which is saying something.
Oh, God, yeah. The whole, when he revives Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio and is just screaming fight at her, is like, if you don't tear up during that moment, you're just spiritually dead.
It's over for you. All right, Jacob, thank you so much for that splendid top five. Now let's find out about the big doings of the entertainment business in the year 1989. Here is Mike with the Hollywood Minute.
Hollywood freaks on the Hollywood scene.
1989 is one of the years that made sensible people fucking hate the Oscars.
Yeah.
As it was the year when Spike Lee's masterpiece, Do the Right Thing, wasn't even nominated for Best Picture. It got a consolation nomination for Best Original Screenplay, and then a Supporting Actor nomination for Danny Aiello. And the Best Picture Oscar went to Driving Miss Daisy, a film whose shook and jive characterization of race in America could not have stood in starker contrast to Lee's of-the-moment snapshot. If you'd like to hear more about that movie, do check out the first episode of our Fun City Cinema podcast.
Jacob, Driving Miss Daisy versus Do the Right Thing. Where do you land on that matchup?
Dude, I can't even remember Driving Miss Daisy. Like, I know I've seen it, I know all the cultural kind of significance or insignificance, I guess, at this point of it. But like, yeah, Do the Right Thing's like a top 10 movie of all time for me. Fuck everything else.
Yeah, definitely.
The big prize winner at Cannes in 89 was Steven Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which was his film debut, launching one of the most reliably excellent careers in the business. It was also the first big hit for Miramax, which was, to put it mildly, a mixed blessing. If you'd like to hear more about that, you can check out our season 1 1989 episode with another beloved Austinite, Mr. John Pearson.
Jacob, you're a fan of Sex Lies as well, yes?
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It still works. It still plays. It's a very, very 1989 movie, and it still very much plays.
Who doesn't want to see James Spader struggling to get a boner?
Not I.
Other big Oscar winners were Oliver Stone, Best Director for Born on the 4th of July, Daniel Day-Lewis and Brenda Fricker, Best Actor and Best Supporting Actress, respectively, for My Left Foot, Jessica Tandy for Best Actress, and Alfred Uhry for Best Original Screenplay for Driving Miss Daisy.
That is a typo. Mike, I'm so sorry. That's a typo. That was Best Adapted Screenplay for Driving Miss Daisy. I'm sorry about that.
Ugh, fuck it. Who cares? Fuck that shit. And Denzel Washington picking up his first Oscar for Best Supporting Actor for Glory. Also, Spike lost Best Original Screenplay to Tom Schulman for Dead Poets Society. God damn. I got Black Caesar at the crib. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Jake, a lot of titles to contemplate in there. Any of note in that batch?
My Left Foot. Is that movie lost to time?
Is what?
Is My Left Foot lost to time at this point?
Kind of, yes.
Like, it's weird. Like, when Mike just said Daniel Day-Lewis won Best Actor, I was like, what? What fucking movie? And he was like, My Left Foot. I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. The movie exists. Yeah.
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade was the biggest box office hit of the year, followed very closely by Tim Burton's Batman, Back to the Future Part 2, Look Who's Talking, and the aforementioned Dead Poets Society. In 1989, we bid a fond farewell to the GOAT actor Laurence Olivier. He was awful, though.
No, he wasn't. Don't do this, Mike. Don't do this.
He was
awful.
He was really good at drinking.
He was. Yes.
Okay, now, see? That's fine. GOAT actress Betty Davis. The GOAT scumbag character actor Joe Spinell.
Mm.
The GOAT director John Cassavetes. The other GOAT director Sergio Leone. The latter's frequent star Lee Van Cleef. Comic legends Lucille Ball and Gilda Radner. The Man of a Million Voices Mel Blanc. And Monty Python's Graham Chapman. They've been making fucking jokes about Graham Chapman since the day he died.
Yes.
Like, literally at his funeral,
yes,
they were cracking jokes.
Yes, and that's just how he would have wanted it. Yeah.
Graham Chapman has had one of the best sort of like public afterlives of just about any star I can think of.
Agreed.
Right? But the big theatrical event of the year for movie nerds was the restoration and re-release of David Lean's magnificent Lawrence of Arabia, a very good movie, which we discuss at length on our 1962 episode.
We're just going to plug all our other shit in this segment. Have you read my book, Fun City Cinema? Jacob, have you ever had the luxury of seeing Lawrence of Arabia on a big screen?
Well, you want to take it back to the Ritz here in Austin. They used to play it almost yearly on 70mm.
Oh, shit.
So I saw it a couple times. Good. That in 2001 were the big ones that they used to bust out that 70mm projector.
Nice.
And yeah, you a movie that you really luxuriate in.
Yeah. Nice to have those standbys on the schedule. Okay, you ready to do a lightning round?
Absolutely.
All right, you know how it works. I'm going to feed you a list of titles pulled from John Willis's Screen World Film Annual for 1989, which I did not bring all the way to Austin just to wave around right now. I have my limits. You can comment briefly on each or pass if you wish. I'm going to have to do a little bit of editing on the fly here because you're so knowledgeable that I'm just looking at this list. I'm like, no, Leviathan, Deep Star, Six Order, they're deep. We talked about those. Talked about Kanjinte. Talked about Black Rain. Okay, I'll find enough, and we'll get a good lightning round out of it. And here we go. Walter Hill's Johnny Handsome.
That's the one with Mickey Rourke, right?
Yep.
It has a really good cast. I think it looks great, but definitely lesser Hill.
You briefly mentioned this one earlier, but I'd love to hear more about Tango and Cash.
Tango and Cash, which I believe one of the great pieces of trivia about Roadhouse is that Swayze, I think, was up for the Kurt Russell role Tango and Cash. Don't love this movie. It almost plays like, you want to talk about a movie that if you are into ironically loving it, I would probably excuse you for it. It's a rare example of me doing that. But like I don't think it quite works. I like the chemistry between Stallone and Kurt Russell. I mean, I like Kurt Russell in anything, so like whatever. But yeah, it's fine.
Cameron Crowe's Say Anything.
Good movie. Wonder how it would play in 2024.
Phil Alden Robinson's Field of Dreams.
Ultimate dad film. Like, I know that's not an original opinion, but I actually just rewatched it we did a baseball movies episode last year or the year before, and I rewatched it on 4K. And man, if you're, again, another movie that if you're not moved by it, you're kind of dead inside. And also, one of the great Ray Liotta roles.
Joe Dante's The Burbs.
Controversial opinion. I know that this has a massive cult following. People adore this movie. It's never clicked with me. There's parts of it that I like. I like young Tom Hanks doing a sort of horrific comedic thing. And sure. Bruce Dern's a lot of fun in it. But I've never been able to find my way into this one.
Harold Becker's Sea of Love.
I mean, come the wet ass hour, I'm everybody's daddy.
Mary Lambert's Pet Sematary.
Better than the remake. This is a movie that I also, kind of like Jason Takes Manhattan, have revisited a whole bunch. I think it's actually aged really well. Kind of plays like a TV movie now, but is still really gnarly. All the stuff with Gage and like the tendon cutting at the end makes me, you know, yeah, do exactly what you just did, which is kind of like recoil. And Fred Gwynn's main accent remains legendary. Wow. Like, who knows what's going on there?
Magnificent. Gleaming the Cube.
Oh, the Christian Slater skateboard movie? Yeah. Piece of shit, but I like it.
Vampire's Kiss.
So while we're on the topic of like ironically or unironically loving stuff, let's talk about Nick Cage for a second. Nick Cage, one of the great screen performers of all time. I don't think there are bad Nick Cage performances, especially when you get into the DTV realm when he's just trying to pay his old tax debt off.
Yep.
But every now and again, I think this is like one of the premier examples that you get into when he coined the term for his own acting style a couple years ago, which was like Nuevo Shamanic or something. And like... this is like almost like exhibit A of like, oh yeah, that's what we expect from Nick Cage, or what we want from Nick Cage when he does a role. Because this is almost like, I had a friend when I worked at the video store here who described it as like being the better B-side to American Psycho, because it's basically about a guy, a yuppie completely devolving into his own fantasy world, only instead of like a serial killer, he's a vampire. Also, isn't this written by the same guy who wrote After Hours?
That sounds right, yes. Yes.
Hulk Hogan and No Holds Barred, brother.
Not the worst Hulk Hogan movie, I'll tell you that much.
Julian Temple's Earth Girls Are Easy.
I never liked this one. We used to play it a lot in the store when I worked at Vulcan Video for a long time, and it just, I don't know. It never, because this is the one with Jeff Goldblum and Gina Davis, right?
Yep.
Yeah, not great.
The aforementioned Robert Englund in The Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, man. So the Dwight Little remake of Phantom of the Opera, which this was 21st Century Film Corporation, which is essentially the offshoot when Golan and Globus broke up and they were trying to basically do a different thing. I like this movie a lot. It's pretty gnarly. I like Dwight Little movies in general because he also made Halloween 4, and he also made one of the better Steven Seagal movies, Marked to Death. Mm-hmm. All of his movies are reliably gross and brutal, and Phantom of the Opera does not disappoint. And also, Robert Englund, man, like, anytime he showed up, like, stretching back to, like, even the 70s when he was in stuff like Toby Hooper's Eaten Alive, like, he shows up and you know you're getting something.
Yes.
I don't know if it's good, but it's certainly fascinating.
And finally, Terry Gilliam's nearly studio bankrupting The Adventures of Baron Munchausen.
Well, Sarah Polley kind of torpedoed this movie, didn't she?
She sure did.
I still really like it, but like, it's hard to watch it now without and divorce yourself from her stories and Gilliam. And also, like, Gilliam... Man, is he one of the most overvalued directors of all time?
I mean, it's been a minute since there was a sort of unreservedly good one, yeah.
Kind of a massive prick, too.
Yeah, kind
anymore,
of.
He's become, like, he's entered that John Cleese territory of, like, old dudes who shouldn't have a microphone in front of them. Like, shut the fuck up, man.
Yep. All right, Jacob, excellent lightning round, as expected. Where can people follow you, read you, listen to you these days?
On Twitter, it's Jacob Q Knight. On Letterboxd, it's Jacob Knight. And then me and Martin are still cranking out Secret Handshake episodes. We have both a Stephen Hopkins and a Charles Bronson episode coming up soon.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, we're pushing between the regular episodes, the bonus episodes, and the filmmaker interviews, which we've done with everybody from Rowdy Harrington to Gaspar Noé. We're up over 100 episodes now. Nice. At this point, I don't think we're going to stop anytime soon because we're both huge losers who just love to watch movies and talk about them in front of microphones. Much like we're doing right now.
I was
going to
say, this sounds like a familiar ethos.
Middle-aged white guys, you know what I'm saying?
Indeed. I'm Fun City Cinema on Instagram, Jason-Bailey on Blue Sky and Letterboxd, where you can find under my list the top fives for every episode of the show, including this one. Mike, where can people follow you?
I am at BrainwashedLib on Twitter and at Fifth Column Films on Blue Sky.
And of course, if you like the show and think other people might like it too, we implore you to leave us a rating or review on your podcatcher of choice. There is...
Hey, can I read you a review?
Oh, yeah, sure.
We got a review.
Uh-oh. Okay, what does it say?
It's super simple.
Okay.
Love the presenters, love the guests, love the years. Sir Pick and Mix a Lot. See how easy that was?
Wow. Okay. Do like that dude did, and we'll be thankful forever. Mike, before we go, what is your parting recommendation for 1989?
Look, I know this is my personal, and I get to just talk about whatever I like in this little short bit of the show. Even with that understanding, I wouldn't normally be so indulgent as to pick Tetsuo the Iron Man.
Whoa.
But we are talking to a proper Austin guy. We're talking to a Vulcan-like employee here. I can fucking say Tetsuo the Iron Man when we're talking to a proper Austin guy. I'm not going to, you know, again, several times we've said, like, I'm not going to say it's great. I'm going to say I love it. If you don't know what the phrase experimental film means when you hear it.
Right.
Go check out Tetsuo the Iron Man. Yeah. It's just such a, like, and this is a movie that is so sort of deep in the weeds that I originally had a clip from it in my video store movie that I've been working on for 10 years, and I took it out because I was like, actually not enough video stores had that movie. I didn't see it on video. I didn't see it until, you know, I don't know, maybe 10 years ago or so. Like, yeah. Definitely a streaming situation. It's on Canopy now. It will blow your fucking mind. It is a really, you know, what I really like the best about Tetsuo the Iron Man is the lead female performance.
Yeah.
Because she sort of actually does really give what is as credible a performance as could be given the situation.
There you go.
She's put in.
Well said.
How about you, buddy?
She's doing the work. She understood the assignment. You know, I'm going to go with the Fabulous Baker Boys.
Oh, yeah.
Which holds a really special place in my heart because it was one of the first grown-up movies that I saw by myself. I was like 13 when it came out. I talked on our bonus episodes about the movie club card to see second run movies in Wichita, Kansas. This was a movie club card selection one week. It was rated R, but I was tall and I was like, are they going to turn me away? So I went to Twin Lakes Theater and I gave them my movie club card and I bought my $1 ticket for Fabulous Baker Boys. And I sat and just everything about it just felt like watching a grown-up movie, that these were grown-up people with grown-up problems. And there was all this great jazz music and it was in just like these rainy, you know, hotel ballrooms in Seattle sort of situations. Jeff Bridges, it was sort of the first movie that made me understand Jeff Bridges. It's an incredible performance by him and Bo Bridges.
It feels fancy and grown up to me now as a grown
right,
up.
Exactly. Him and Bo Bridges play brothers in that, so there's so much of their own baggage that's invested in these really rich performances. And it's the movie that made Michelle Pfeiffer a star. Like, she had done a few things, she'd even had leading roles before, but this is a fucking knockout movie star performance. And I revisit this one every couple of years and it still holds up. It's a great, great little movie.
Not to interject, I just wanted to ask Mike one quick question. Mike, since you like Tetsuo a lot, have you ever seen A Snake of June? It's Tsukamoto's like kind of erotic thriller.
No.
He's going to now.
Definitely look that movie up. I think it'll blow your mind.
There you go.
If you like movies, take your ass to Austin. Get in random conversations. You will learn something, all right?
Here's the thing. You could take the guy out of the video store, but you can't take the video store out of the guy. And when you have a conversation with a video store guy, you're going to get a recommendation. You got to get your next rental. Thank you again, Jacob.
Yeah, no problem.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Jason.
And thank you for listening.